just picked up a fault in the RPG X-ray unit. This can only be attributable to human error. It's going to go 100% failure in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to RPG X-Ray, the podcast that looks inside what makes RPGs tick. If you're a role-playing gamer that wants to think about the hidden systems inside the games we love to play, join us for a regular discussion of the theory and practice of tabletop role-playing. This episode's topic is mysteries. What does investigative gaming look like in tabletop RPGs? Are all RPG mystery games at their heart? Are there games which appear to be detective and mystery-oriented that aren't mystery games at all? What is great play when it comes to mystery games? Hopefully you come out of this episode with clues that you can use in your own mystery gaming. As a reminder, before we get rolling, please stay in touch with us and send in your own thoughts and questions. We are reachable via links on our website, RPGXray, or via our email, contact@rpgxray.com. Joining the X-Ray team today are Jason Beaumont, Eric Saltwell, and myself, Ethan Schoonover. As always, before jumping into the main course, we'd like to start things off with an amuse-bouche we call Appendix X. So in Appendix X, we do a little summary of the media we're consuming currently with a particular eye toward how it could be applied to gaming. Eric, do you want to start us off this time?
Yeah, sure. So I have a little bit of a weird or different, maybe cheating. I have been watching a lot of YouTube tutorials on ChatGPT, and I want to describe how it applies to me to gaming. So I just started a new campaign, and we did some world building using some mini games. We did Our Pantheon, and we did Garrett Ryder Hanrahan's 13th Age Age Building Supplement, and use that to create our setting. And now I'm in the process of using ChatGPT to go through and build Wikipedia articles for all the stuff in our world. So I started by taking everything that happened in the game, feeding it to ChatGPT, and then having it write Wikipedia articles that I'm putting in our online world database.
Wow. That's really impressive. That's, you know, you always do like kind of like a next level prep compared to like every DM I've ever played with. So, yeah. But that's really cool. So then are players going to use like phones at the table to like look at like the Wikipedia or?
No, I actually don't have any real expectation that anyone will ever look at this, and I would not write it myself. That's part of why I wanted to use ChatGPT. We actually implemented this time around a no screens at the table rule. So it is kind of a reminder for me or a brainstorming source for me, but I think that this is worth the level of investment of having ChatGPT write it, partially because I don't think it's going to see a lot of real use. It's just scratching creative itches, right?
Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
I'll be curious to see how that works out. I mean, it's such a big question, like both the appropriate use, the effective use of machine learning tools for gaming, for any creative hobby, I guess. God, there's so many mixed feelings about this.
Yep.
Especially when it comes to like publishers using it, that I have a lot more. Like I'm 100% okay with leveraging things to sort of amplify your individual intellect at the table for a personal game. I think that's a totally legit use.
Yep.
Certainly like putting artists out of work with machine learning tools trained on their own art is a much harder sell for me personally, but
yeah, I know you and I have talked a bunch about that. We're on different places in that spectrum, but I certainly agree that it is full of moral traps.
Well, I think it's okay to use. I think that there's a lot of ethical considerations when it comes to publishers using it.
Yeah,
I think
sure.
that's my line in the sand right now. So,
and I think that that's fair and makes sense. I will say it's actually been surprisingly challenging that I have enough material that came out of these two mini games that we played that getting ChatGPT to remember everything that happened in those two games and then build articles that are based off of all of that material has been surprisingly hard. That's actually why I've been doing a lot of YouTube videos, has been trying to figure out how to build up that that sense of memory for ChatGPT, because of course it's not trained on any of this content.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of the more cutting edge stuff right now is in just, you know, doing your own weights based on custom trained ML.
Yep. Yep.
So, all right, Jason, how about you? You've kind of that 1,000-yard stare today.
Yeah, I'm pretty tired. Yeah, I'm pretty tired. My youngest daughter was up most of the night because she got scared of something she saw in a Roblox game. So I'm a little low energy. So I will say, like, I've been playing this game Redfall that everyone is kind of mad about. And people, like, it's getting, you know, really poor reviews, and people are kind of, you know, really down on its quality, et cetera. But for me, what's interesting is, so the game is a Salem's Lot kind of style game where you're like a band of kind of like young people that are kind of liberating a town that has been taken over by vampires. And you're solving the mystery of why the town, you know, why all these vampires started forming in the town, what caused the town to kind of, you know, descend into chaos. And your base of operations is like this firehouse, and you kind of work out of it and you liberate different kind of parts of the city. And it reminds me a lot of the metagame in Blades of the Dark, where, you know, yeah, there's the game that you're playing, there's the heist that you're doing, but what I've enjoyed is kind of that clearing of the city and, you know, that kind of methodical cleansing of it. The AI is super broken, and to me, that's almost like a feature at my age. Like, the game is so easy to play. You know, the vampires half the time, like, you know, don't even move when you sneak up on them. And so that's, you know, kind of takes away like a bunch of the challenge, which I'm fine with. I don't care. But yeah, it's been inspiring for me because I really enjoy in RPGs when you get a sense of place and you are exerting kind of change over the place where your story is being told. I think it's why I like hex crawls or even like Keep on the Borderland style things where, you know, you're kind of bringing like order to chaos. That I think is a fun part of RPG play that, you know, kind of the more narrative games don't give you as much of a sense of sometimes. Whereas I think when you do hex crawls and kind of maybe more old school play, you really kind of get a sense of, great, like, this dungeon has been cleared of monsters. It's gone. I've accomplished that. And that this video game is kind of scratching that itch for me.
I so feel that. Yes, yeah. I really get it. Right. You know, did you want to add anything else to your Appendix X before I comment?
No, please talk.
I have been playing, in terms of video games, I've been playing Far Cry 5. Which is not the most great recent one. Far Cry game. Right. Love it. I mean, honestly, I am a sucker for the Far Cry series.
Yeah.
And their, you know, their quality is, it varies up and down, but Far Cry 5 is really doing it for me, which is the premise is basically you're in Montana. It's been taken over by this fascist cult and, you know, no relation to modern America whatsoever, obviously. that sense of accomplishment, like just like clearing out towns, clearing out encampments, whatever, like, it's so satisfying. And actually, it's funny that you say like you like the easy thing, because I do too. I don't have time for anything
right
too challenging. And it's, I just got to the first boss fight and I'm like, nah, I may not make it past this. Right. Like, in terms of the whole game, I might just like throw in the towel. Anyhow, but what I'm really, those were not my Appendix X picks. I'm actually reading a couple of books right now, which are kind of, they're both kind of like hex crawls in a way. Yeah. So I just wrapped up Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's the first time I've read that book. Probably not. But that book is so weirdly transformative for me personally. It's this kind of very philosophical journey. It's a conversation between Marco Polo and Kublai Khan, and they're, you know, talking about all the cities that Marco Polo may or may not have been through. Which all have women's names, you know. So I don't know if it's not clear. Are they people? Are they cities? Are they just imaginings? And it's an amazing book. Every time I read that, it's the sheer volume and like the sort of like the mathematical quality of it, where it's like this very kind of structured procession. is so neat. But it's, you know, it's like a, it's also kind of like an adventure, right? Like each city that he goes through has this really tight description, has a really tight theme. They're often very like philosophical themes, but they're also like really like beautifully envisioned. And he'll often talk about the architecture, which has like their cities that like float in the air and have rooks everywhere. And, you know, the people never touch the ground. And you're like, actually, this would be a really cool RPG setting as well.
Right.
So, so there's that. And then I've been reading notes on Blood Meridian. And just because of the passing of Cormac McCarthy, and I love Blood Meridian as a book. I know that some people, you either love it or you hate it, I guess, or you just couldn't finish it. But I really enjoy Blood Meridian, and there's a whole book about sort of filling in the gaps, like it's the footnotes, all the footnotes that were not in the book, not by McCarthy, but by John Sepik.
And how do you think how do you think about that book in relationship to gaming?
I mean, it's a hex crawl, isn't it? Like, it's literally one of the great things is, I think, actually, I'm trying to remember if in the published version of Blood Meridian, if there's a map in the beginning of the book or not, but there are so many maps that you can find that actually do plot out the progress of the book. It's very much based in physical reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he spent a lot of time when he was writing it in that area. You have these like mythic quality characterizations in the band of adventurers, and they're terrible people, but they're really spot on for a D&D party. You know, they are literal murder hobos.
Right.
In the most horrific sense. And there's something about that book, which is there's a lack of resolution a lot of times as they sort of traipse across the landscape, but they literally just traipse across, and it's sort of it's almost a Shaggy Dog story too, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's, you know, you wait for resolution, you wait for characters to change, and it's not clear that any of them ever do, right? They're all very mythic in that sense. So yeah, I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts. That would be a separate 12-hour podcast that I'll be releasing. So anyhow. So yeah, Far Cry and Blood Meridian, slightly different stuff, but I actually have to say, you know, my son's been playing Redfall, loves it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, Cyberpunk 2077 got bad reviews when it came out, and I finished that game. I loved that game.
Yeah, I love that game too. I played it twice.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think there's definitely a difference in how people approach video games when they like consume maybe a lot of them, and they, you know, they are connoisseurs of it, and they want to, they're able to kind of critique it in a different way that I think, you know, I think as you get older, you just have less time, and you're like, yeah, this is fine. I don't need, you know, more than this. Right. Yep. So, yeah.
All right. Well, should we jump into the main topic?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
All right. Eric, why don't you lead us off? This was, you know, like a lot of our topics, I think that, you know, we sort of brainstormed a huge list of possible topics, and you've done a good job sort of corralling them into some sort of semblance of order and structure. So why don't you lead us off and talk to us about what we're going to discuss today?
Yeah, that's great. Today we're talking about mystery gaming or investigative gaming. And I think one of the interesting things is that, of course, mystery and investigation are really one of the core types of activities in RPGs. Although I don't think we often call it that, right? We often talk about exploration rather than mystery. We often talk about exploration, role-playing, and combat. That's certainly the triangle on which 5e builds itself. But I think this is actually huge and hugely important, and you find role-playing games that are dedicated to it and some that have mechanics that support it and some that kind of brush it aside. Actually, Ethan, maybe you could give us your definition of what you think the definition of mystery gaming is.
So I have kind of specific thoughts on this. I think this kind of bifurcates into two different types of mystery gaming. There are mystery games where players solve the mystery, the meat brains at the table solve the mystery, and there are mystery games that simulate mystery where the player characters are solving the mystery. And within, so, you know, that I've sort of created a Venn diagram where with two separate circles there, those may overlap, and they often overlap.
Can you provide some examples of each of those? I think that's sure. a super interesting concept. Yeah. It's yeah. pretty deep.
So I think that in, for me, let's talk about, I'm going to give you maybe two examples here, two or three examples. So one example is in classic kind of Dungeons and Dragons, 1980s D&D, you know, born like Athena from the head of wargaming. You have a game that is mechanically structured around wargaming, but very quickly over a course of a decade or so, it starts to adopt a lot of tropes of mystery solving. And you end up with adventures that have an actual mystery in them. Like, why is, you know, where are these monsters coming from? Why are they invading this town? Who's creating these unnatural beasts? And so there's usually a payoff at the end of those adventures, even though mechanically D&D is absolutely purely, you know, wargaming applied but starting to adopt these other genres. And then you have, so that's, for me, that's one type. And that continues, I think, in many ways throughout the history of D&D, even through today, where we still have that mechanical kind of wargaming framework, but we have the narrative frameworks of mysteries and other genres. And then, and the other genres could be, you know, political intrigue. But so another example would be the Gumshoe System, developed by Robert D. Laws, and many games published by Pelgrane Press. So in the Gumshoe System, Robin D. Laws took a look at D&D and other games that Call of Cthulhu that are mystery solving games. And he said, and actually Call of Cthulhu is a good example between the two. These are really fun, except for the fact that quite often you have to roll some dice to find out whether or not you get the clue. And people fail that roll all the time. And then it's really on the game master to kind of, you know, it's the classic, like, oh man, the players didn't discover the secret door. I have to figure out a way to make them discover the secret door. I'm going to have them roll again. And then I'll have the thief roll. And then I'll have the wizard roll. You know, like you're just doing backflips to like make a fun aspect of the mystery reveal itself. And in Gumshoe, Robin D. Law said, hey, you know, information is free. You always get the clue, especially the core clues, and the mystery always progresses because of that.
So I think what I'm hearing from you, and I want to get back to this, who's investigating? Is it the player or the character? But
I didn't answer that because I think in both D&D and Gumshoe, it can be both, depending on who wrote the session, the scenario.
So let's come back to that in a second, because I think that that's a really interesting topic. But what I'm hearing you say is one of the things that makes investigative mystery gaming different is that, unlike, let's say, something where you're trying to convince someone to pass a bill in Congress, or you're trying to get the town to prepare for an oncoming attack, that in investigative mystery gaming, failure is not fun, that it blocks the game, it stops it, and it doesn't create higher tension scenarios down the line. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, if we define failure as failure to get the clue, failure to get the information. And I, you know, honestly, I think it's not fun in D&D, even though failure to get the clue is built into the system because it's a wargaming mechanic. That's my thesis. I submit it to the committee for review.
Ethan, you're a big fan of the Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective board game.
So much, yes.
How is that? Yeah, I'm going to keep playing with this a little bit, because that one's purely the meat brain, like the actual human beings are solving the mystery, right? How do you fold like that in? Like, how does that kind of play into your theory of kind of like mystery RPGs?
Yeah, I think about this all the time. So for those folks who don't know it, Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective is a series of tabletop board games, I guess we would call them. And they come with pre-written mysteries. You can play them alone. You can play them with a group of people. And you just basically take turns reading a pre-written text. And each pre-written text is a scene that gives you some information. And then you can choose on a map of London where you're going to go to next and who you're going to talk to or what scene you're going to investigate. And each visit to a scene or a person is pre-written text. And through that process, you collect through copious notes and writing down times and writing down, you know, names of people and motives. You collect information in your player human brain. You nominally play the Baker Street Irregulars, but you're not inhabiting that character. There's no opportunity for role play. There's no dice rolling. You're just getting information into your human brain and solving it. And it's pure. For me, that's like pure mystery solving. Those games must be very hard to create, by the way, because you really are writing a mystery and you're writing an asynchronous mystery because people can collect the information in any order. Eric, you were going to ask me a question.
So can you give an example? So I think that that's a great example, and I understand it, about how players...
Yeah.
Can solve mysteries. But the players, the person playing the game, what does it mean to say that in some cases you do the opposite, which is that the character solves a mystery?
Yeah. And I think I don't have a good example of a game of a non-computer game, I should say, where a player character solves a mystery. But let's use a computer game, a computer role-playing, like point-and-click mystery game as an example. All right. So if you have a typical kind of point and click mystery game playing a video game, you are able to collect clues by clicking on them. And there are mystery games that attempt to allow the player to exercise some deduction on their own and combine clues and do things like that. But oftentimes it's just a matter of clicking on the right, you know, the right area on the screen. You collect the clue. You've got the clue. When you've got the right number of clues, the mystery is solved. And then you can go to the library or you can go confront the culprit and you're done. There's no actual deduction happening. And I think that that happens in RPGs. So, for instance, in Gumshoe, there are real mechanics built around allowing this to happen where you can say, you know, if so-and-so has a skill related to library science, then your character's in the library and they are able to research and find two books that bear on this case, and cross-referencing them, you realize that, you know, the person that hired you is actually the inheritor to this vast fortune.
Okay.
So, you know, instead of presenting you with information like here's a name, here's a, you know, printed list of, adoption papers that, you know, you have, here's some other information I sort of like spread it out on the table in front of you, which could happen in the RPG. And maybe that's fun and maybe it's not. I don't know. I want you to answer that question. But you really are presenting it as a fait accompli. Your character has solved this connection. Your character has put together this information.
Right.
So that, I don't know if that answers it sufficiently, but that to me is the player character solving a part of the puzzle.
So is it fair? I think about some systems where there are skill checks, right? And let's say the GM has left a clue that there's a muddy footprint under the bed. And in a world where, tell me if I'm getting this right.
Yeah.
If the player is intended to do the investigation, then the GM is waiting for the player to say, I look under the bed. Versus if the player character is doing the investigation, then the player might just say, I do a search. And the GM says, make a search roll. Or in Gumshoe, you would just tell them. But at that point, if they make the search check, then that character has correctly investigated versus the player being the one who's doing that deduction. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a slight difference there, which is you're talking about a mechanical event, which is finding something under a bed or choosing to look under a bed. And I guess I'm less concerned about that. I think that there's a role for allowing, you know, volition and mapping that discovery against both the player at the table, the player choice to look under the bed, as well as perhaps the skill set of the player character. But I think that, let me differentiate there between the mechanical choices, sort of the general skill choices, and putting together big parts of the puzzle. Insight. I guess I'm talking about insight. So like discovering the shoe print is not insight. Okay. In your meat brain, when you're playing consulting detective, you're creating insight. Your brain is turning into an insight generating machine. Okay. In a investigative game where the player, where the mystery solving is purely simulated. Okay. And I don't think this pure simulation of mystery right. solving is, it exists entirely, but in that scenario, the insight that is achieved is handed to you. And let me explain why. Like, you know, it's, we play D&D. We've all done this where, you know, the classic example is the bard wants to seduce somebody. I hate that example, but it is a it's an example. Okay. And so I say, well, okay, tell me, you know, what is the bard saying to
right.
the princess to seduce her? Right. Or, you know, what is your wizard saying to negotiate peace? And I'm asking you on the spot to come up with some riff. But I could also just say, like, well, okay, good enough. You know, 30 seconds of you kind of hemming and hawing and, you know, D&D nerds having famously excellent social skills, you know, coming up with like the worst pickup lines imaginable. Go ahead and roll for seduction. Go ahead and roll for negotiation. And then that's the real answer. You know, the rest is just flavor.
You know, the thing that I think out of all of that, the thing that really gets my goat and that I have a hard time with is when people are expected to say, here's what I say.
Right.
And then they do a roll and the thing they choose to say doesn't impact the difficulty of the
right.
roll.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you see what I'm trying to like correlate? So we often will do these types of like, weird hybrid player engagement along with player character like automated success rolling.
Yep. So I'd love a framework. There's never been a framework I didn't love. And I think what you're proposing is that there's a framework. Tell me if I'm taking us off base, by the way. But I think what you're saying is that there's a framework where there's a mystery has kind of three pieces. One is going and collecting the clues, and some clues are clues about what the mystery, and some clues are just clues that lead you to other clues. But then there is this insight piece that you're talking about. So first you do clue hunting, then you do insight and integration to try to solve the mystery using the clues you've got, and then you go and do something about it. And that those are the three pieces of an investigative skeleton. And at least for both of the first two, Ethan, I think you're saying there is a choice about is it the player who's doing each of those first two pieces? Or is it the character?
So there's an investigate, synthesize, and then act, basically, yep. Right?
And there's even some games like Brindlewood Bay and some other, like there's some Forged in the Dark games that are, I'm sure the name escapes me, but based off of Men in Black, roughly, where as you collect clues, you get points, and that if you get enough points, you solve the problem. And right. in fact, synthesis is replaced with generation. So rather than you say like, oh, okay, you figured it out. The GM's going to tell you what's going on. The player then wins the right to say, here's what's going on, right? Or in the Forged in the Dark version, I'm not sure how it is in Brindlewood Bay, as you collect clues, you get more and more dice. And whenever the players are ready, they say, I'm going to solve it. Here's what I think the solution is. And then you roll the body of dice to figure out if you're right or not.
Interesting. So it's like getting a stock option.
Yep, that's exactly right. Huh.
Would you ever have a situation where a player at your table says, my character says this, you know, solve some part of the mystery, and you say, you know, no, I don't think your character would have that knowledge, or I don't think your character would have that kind of insight. I've never done that, and I wonder if any of you ever have or would.
Wow, that's a big question.
I think it's at the core of your player versus character kind of mystery thing.
Yeah,
is that kind of that negative case? And would you ever just say, no, that's something you as a player figured out, but your character has an intelligence of three or whatever.
Yeah, right? No, I think it's a great point. I think that there are, I've never done it, which is really interesting. Like, why haven't I done it? I guess I feel like I've never been presented with a situation where, and maybe it's because I haven't played enough Gumshoe, but I've never been presented with a situation where I felt like somebody overstepped that. I also feel like I have never played, when I play Gumshoe, there's usually some sort of like meat brain inference and synthesis component.
Mm-hmm.
And which for me has always been the assumed fun part.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really question whether or not it is, but it, because of that, I feel like, you know, people have been kind of like offloading. They've never jumped to that. My player solves the mystery.
Right.
Or my character solves the mystery. Right. So
for me, I feel like that gets to what is great play when you're investigating.
Is it?
Is great play when you're investigating? Do you set an expectation with the players that the goal that you're doing when you sit down as a player, your meat brain, is it that you're intended to figure it out and figuring it out is fun and is great play? Or is it the case that because failure is not compelling, that's not the element of great play in an investigative game? And I get a little lost here because if it's not, then I don't know what is the thing that players are trying to do when they play.
That's right.
Okay, so let me give you an example though. Like if I give you a dungeon and you do a dungeon crawl through that, that can be fun, right? Because you're going back to your video game example, right, Jason? Like it's fun to clear the dungeon, right? It's fun. Like Keep on the Borderlands, played that so many times, going through the Caves of Chaos because it was fun to clear out the Caves of Chaos for us. Would it be fun today? I don't know. I think maybe it would be, actually. So, it's fun to achieve that, just the satisfaction of a kind of a completionism. And I can see that being fun in a mystery game without solving anything. Like just sort of like, you know, it's like going on a boat ride at a fun park, right? Like you go through the scary tunnel and you see all the animatronics and you're not really making any choices, but you're sort of engaged and you're having an emotional response and it's fun and it's titillating and that's cool. And then you come out the other end and that was a good ride.
But would you say at that point, is it really still an investigative game?
That's a great question.
Right,
is it?
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right.
Yeah, I think it's not. I think this is, so in the intro we say, you know, like are there mystery games that are not actually mystery games? And I think that's it. You know, then you're playing a dungeon crawl.
Yep.
And for me, like the key question about Gumshoe as a system and about other types of, you know, similarly structured games is, are they really mysteries? Like, and what is that relationship, which I don't think is always made explicit, between the player character automatically synthesizing and then the right mix of the player meat brain synthesizing information?
So when I think about this, I think, you know, we talked in episode one about what is the nature of fun in role-playing games. And one of the topics we touched on is curiosity. And I actually think maybe a better way to phrase those Gumshoe type games is they're actually not mystery games. They're not investigative games. They are discovery and curiosity games. That the fun we get out of them is maybe not in the solving, but in the curiosity of reading what happens in the book.
Yeah.
Which I think makes it a much less interactive gamey experience. But still, I think we're all hardwired to find those things fun.
Okay.
I think that may be true. The counter example, though, for me is like the last time that we played Yellow King together as a big group, there easily, like especially once we were about halfway through the scenario, and that was a pretty long scenario, by the way. I mean, I think we had like, I don't know, 10 sessions. It was a long number of sessions. But once we got about halfway through and all the players had achieved sort of a critical mass of like, we're in Paris, it's the Belle Epoque, and like sort of like just general knowledge. And then it had also accumulated enough information about what was going on and had enough clues. There would be like 15 to 20 minutes of discussion at the beginning of every session, debating, like very active debate about like what was happening. You know, what's like, who's behind this?
That's right.
Which honestly was one of my favorite parts of that game.
Mine too. I reflect a little bit on some of the Masks of Nyarlathotep sessions we've had,
Yes.
Where you're like, it's very similar, Ron, where you get into this situation where you're like, okay, the players are just talking. They're just like, right. And that's fun. Like, you know, the action's not moving forward. You're not like engaging in like actual role play of any kind at that moment. No dice are being thrown. But the table talk is you collectively getting into the story together, right? And that's fun. That's a lot of fun. So
I think that leads into a good discussion about some of the modern investigative games where it's less of a traditional RPG because the GM doesn't come with the mystery already solved. I'm thinking about right. I'm thinking of Inspectors, and Brindlewood Bay falls into that category. And what is the nature of the GM? Is it that because these are about curiosity, your expectation is that it's only fun if the GM is already come in with a scenario and it's about the curiosity of understanding it? Or is there a place for games like Inspectors where the players are coming up with the solution? And if so, what is the fun there? Jason, what do you think about that?
I'm not sure I'm the right person to call on yet. I'm still kind of slow today.
Yeah, I have. Okay, I'm going to jump in here because I.
Yeah, please do.
You know, I have a strong feeling for me personally that games. So for the audience, like when we're talking about Inspectors, we are talking about a game where the players are sort of like on the fly creating a lot of the answers and world building and mystery. And there's a lot of games like this where players have a lot of agency, players, mind you, not player characters, but players have a lot of agency in crafting the world and the experience and what's going on. And you sort of are, you know, you've scattered breadcrumbs in front of them, but they're kind of, it's like a random distribution. And then it's up to the players to sort of sort them into piles. And that process to me is a little less, it's fun, but it's a little less satisfying than the feeling that there's a human intent. There was a human mind behind creating a mystery that it's up to me to solve. There's world building that I'm going to look into. Like, okay. I absolutely have enjoyed playing like procedurally generated video games and roguelikes where you're in this like infinite dungeon and you just keep going through. Now as an adult, I find those less satisfying than when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
I'm currently playing Diablo 4 and I am absolutely experiencing this. I feel like because it's just computer generated, and maybe this is just how good is the generation, I feel like it's just meaningless. Like those are differences, but I don't have curiosity for them because I know the freedom the machine has doesn't have meaning that's tied into the story or the situation.
Is it? It is actually why I like Gumshoe, you know, because the stories, I think we've talked about this sometimes, that we always enjoy reading Gumshoe stories more than we like maybe enjoy it at the table. Right. And I think that what to me, like the Gumshoe adventures I've played have had some of the best mystery authorship, you know, of any tabletop RPGs I've played. And so while I don't feel like I'm really enjoying the system as we're doing it, I definitely am having a lot of fun being the unique characters that Gumshoe lets you into. And then the storylines are interesting, you know, as well. I think Ethan, you might have had some experience with Bubble Gumshoe. Is that correct? Or did you?
Yeah, it's, you know, Bubble Gumshoe. I'm eternally crafting a Bubble Gumshoe world. Mm-hmm. So Bubble Gumshoe is a Gumshoe system game. And it's Kenneth Height, and I have it around here somewhere, and I apologize. I'll find out. We can put in the show notes a link to it. But it was three different authors, and I know Kenneth Height was involved, but I don't know if he was the primary. So it's basically like if Veronica Mars was a Gumshoe game.
Right.
And for me, actually, the vibe is a little bit, is somewhere between like is Scooby-Doo and Veronica Mars.
Is it?
Although it doesn't have any sort of overt like supernatural themes or anything like that, I think it would be fun to toss those in. But if you've, you know, it's, the idea is, you know, it's a small town, you are students, high school students, and your skill set maps nicely. So like there's no cop talk, but there's like, I think there's like adult talk or something, or like grown up talk or something.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Where you can like talk to adults well.
And that's kind of cool. I like that skill. Oh, that's a good
one. Yeah. There's like, you know, photography and computer skills and things like that. So, you know, you're simulating solving little mysteries in your town. And I just really am excited to craft something in that world.
Yeah.
I think it seems like a fun. Anyhow, sorry. Why were you asking me about that? Besides the fact that it seems super cool and you're going to play it with me.
Yeah. No. I was thinking about just kind of the stories. So, one of the things I think that's interesting about mysteries is, as just mystery games as a genre, is I do think there are these subgenres within mysteries that help us understand the type of mystery we're solving. A murder mystery, you kind of know, you know, a bit like that, what's going into that. And Bubblegum Shoot to me felt like a really interesting system that focuses on kind of the Encyclopedia Brown, you know, style of play. And I was asking about it kind of like in the interest of, I do think that the definition of mystery can be incredibly sprawling. Like we've said, like it could be a dungeon crawl, it could be all of these things. And I really think that these systems that kind of focus in on a subgenre of mysteries, both thematically and with their mechanics, I think it helps kind of get the players into the space of the kind of mystery they're solving. That's kind of brought it up from there. Well, actually, I have a question for you, Eric, which is Knight's Black Agents a mystery?
So here's, I think Knight's Black Agents is really interesting because almost all the mechanics that you find outside of just give them the clue, right? I mean, there are investigative points just like any other gumshoe game.
Can you describe it for those that haven't played it?
Yeah, totally. So Knight's Black Agents is a game of Jason Bourne versus vampires. And so you play super spies, you play people who are making a team like you'd find in Ronin, and you're fighting the supernatural. So you're at the peak of human capability, fighting things that are much, much more powerful than you. And it's a gumshoe game. And it is very, there are intended to be investigative components. I think when we talked about this three-part structure of clue hunting, synthesis, and then do something about it, it is intended to have all three of those. But it is also very, very tactical. It is like it leans heavily on the Jason Bourne and the finding traps and using technology to protect yourself. And so I think it is intended to be investigative and have that curiosity component. But most of the mechanics, and it is a very mechanics heavy rule system in my impression, are really about that other piece. They're about the what Gumshoe would call general play, right? Which is, or procedure, or yeah.
And it does have a mechanic, I think I have this game right, that's about like a larger global conspiracy.
Yep.
Because conspiracy is another type of mystery genre that, you know, I think Masks of Nyarlathotep that we talked about earlier falls into that as well, which is, you know, kind of like what the players are trying to figure out is not a localized mystery, who murdered somebody. It is a multi-session play of what is a global mystery. And there's lots of like kind of like sub mysteries within it. And I think that Knight's Black Agents has a specific kind of conspiracy mechanic. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, and I think that conspiracies and uncovering and taking down conspiracies have got to be one of the top four or five campaign structures you find out there.
Right.
And Gumshoe has a really, I actually really love what they do. They have something called the Conspiramid. I was reading the notes for NBA, which is the short term for Knight's Black Agents. And it was written by Kenneth Haidt, based on Gumshoe by Robin Laws. And Ken was saying in the notes at the end that he took the Conspiramid from somebody else and gave them credit. But the idea is that you write out a pyramid where at the top is the conspiracy comes and hunts you down and kills you. And then down below that are things that the conspiracy does to mess with you that are less and less impact. And so you pick something at the bottom tier, which is like, oh, you're being followed, right? It's something that is much more innocuous. Or, oh, you start to hear clicks on the phone when you've picked the phone up. Mm-hmm. And then you walk your way up the conspiramid as, and it's the way, it's a way to represent how the bad guys react to you. There are some other structures there too, where they talk about laying out the conspiracy all up as a pyramid, which is just like a, oh, you know, there's going to be a street level something, right? Which for vampires, Ken is always saying it's either going to be blood or money, or there's a third one I don't remember, right? But there's going to be like, oh yeah, they're associated with the mafia who's smuggling cigarettes just because they need money, right?
Right.
And then you're always rolling up from the street level to the heart of the conspiracy, which is really the structure of your adventure. So you might have seven sessions as you roll your way up the conspiracy. And at every point you get clues that lead higher and higher into that pyramid. And then in addition, while you're doing that, you become under the notice of the conspiracy. And so they are taking higher and higher level actions on the conspiramid as a way to build tension and have the bad guy feel alive and proactive and not just reactive. So I do think it's pretty interesting.
When you say this, when you describe it, it sounds like a dungeon crawl to me, where you're going deeper and deeper into the dungeon.
Is it?
And there's just like thematic changes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I also feel like, yeah, I'm really glad that you snapped it back to conspiracies being just a useful campaign construct. It started to kind of make me think about past campaigns I've run and whether they really were a conspiracy at their heart, a conspiracy mystery at their heart. And, you know, I'll use, you know, Eric and I both ran a D&D Horde of the Dragon Queen campaign that, you know, we turned that thing into like a 3-year long, ridiculous like thing. But that really starts with, here's this crazy dragon army. What are they? What are they doing? Why are they, you know, gathering all this gold? Why are they raiding all these towns? And to me, that the conspiramid mechanic would have been such a useful thing for me to have in my tool case during that kind of DMing. Because kind of what you want is, you want, as the players are exploring the world, you want the interplay between the players have affected the world somehow, and the person behind the mystery is reacting to what the players are doing. And the conspiramid just seems like a great way to kind of structure that, like to help you with your prep and how to think about that. And I think that kind of dynamic mystery is a more exciting tabletop mystery play than, eventually you'll figure out who murdered the person and why there's blood underneath the bed or whatever, right? Like that one just has like an answer, right? Whereas I think the conspiracy play has lots of reveals as you go on. And to me, that feels like a more satisfying RPG construction than maybe a murder mystery. So.
Yeah. No, I really like this. I mean, I keep thinking, have you both seen Veronica Mars, by the way?
Uh-huh.
No.
Okay.
You'd like it, Eric. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I will avoid all spoilers, but it's enough to say that the structure of Veronica Mars every season is that there are like per episode mysteries, and then there's an overarching grand mystery. And, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, I'm thinking about Bubblegum Shoe. I'm also thinking about playing in cosmic horror. You know, in cosmic horror, you have sort of your small mysteries, and then you have the overarching cosmic horror that you're slowly becoming aware of. And there is definitely a correlation between the revelation of cosmic horror, which in Call of Cthulhu is represented by your like decreasing sanity, among other things, and the awareness of the conspiracy pyramid, the conspiramid.
Right.
I got to work on that. So, but the idea that there's the large arc and the small arcs, right?
Yeah.
And it's so, I so often focus on the small hops, the small arcs, the episodes, and forget about that big arc. But dropping in those like small points, yeah, like you said, like the clicking of the telephone, yeah, Jason,
yeah.
You were.
It's I would say it's like X-Files, right? X-Files, you know, as a TV show would alternate between that monster of the week and then what's the conspiracy kind of episode that kind of advances the plot, right? And I think in RPG play, this whole conversation is kind of remaking me think about, I think that the mysteries as a construct for campaigns, you need to have kind of the monster of the week version. You need to have the thing in the session that makes the session satisfying. And then you need to have the overarching construct that makes the campaign play satisfying, right? And I hate to keep coming back to the conspiracy, but it feels like that's such a nice formal way to kind of plot that out as a DM and how to really kind of get your campaign structured in a really satisfying way. So it feels like it's a tool that could just be applied to all sorts of different kinds of campaigns.
Was Knights Black Agents the first Gumshoe game?
I think published? Trail of Cthulhu came first.
Yeah.
And I think maybe did the mutant one and the space one, Jason, also come
mutant
first?
Mutant City Blues.
Mutant City Blues and then Ash and Stars and...
maybe Esoterrorists.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's interesting that we keep coming back to, the three of us come back to a Gumshoe a lot, four of us with Brendan, right? Like, we talk, it's so foundational in, I think, how we think about RPGs. And yet, if any of us were like, do you want to play a Gumshoe one? We'd be like, no, let's go do this other thing, right? It's so strange that, like, we've talked about how it has fascinating mechanics, how it's introduced interesting ideas for how to structure and think about campaigns, how it's probably the most thoughtful, besides maybe Brindlewood Bay, maybe unique approach, right, to our mysteries, right? And yet it doesn't see the table. I wonder why that is.
I know why, though. I can give you an answer, and it's because of this this unresolved conflict for me between, like, what is the intent? Is it a funhouse ride?
Is it,
you know, sort of that curiosity fest, right? Like where you're just like, oh, look, pretty, you know, and you're walking through. But I mean, you know, you're taking actions, and those actions reveal the fun tableau, right?
Right.
Or are you solving a mystery? And you know, very clearly, like it's all about solving a mystery, right? That's what it says on the box. It says on the tin, solve mysteries.
Right.
So. For me, it's that tension doesn't get resolved well. And I always feel like there is one of the reasons why I listen to Ken and Robin talk about stuff is because I want to understand their mindset in terms of like how they designed and how they write for Gumshoe. And there was a very recent episode where they talked about how different writers of Gumshoe systems and games have approached it very differently. And Ken was actually saying, like, if I could wave a magic wand and go back in time, I would actually enforce the way that I do it a little bit more than the way it's been done.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Huh. And which has to do with a really core aspect, which is clue discovery.
And
whether or not, you know, it's like challenging to find clues or not challenging to find clues. I won't go into all of that. I will look up the episode number, but I think it's something about like it's a good gun or something like that was the title of the episode.
All right.
That's for me, like part of it is just like what type of game is it? Doesn't have a clear answer for me. It's not necessarily a mystery game, or maybe it can be, but not in the way that we think.
Yes, they're mystery stories, but I'm not convinced they're mystery games.
Yeah. But D&D, I mean, we play D&D all the time, and we are really like stretching the wargaming DNA of that
totally,
game to
right?
a breaking point on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the point where I think people, I mean, we all agree on this, I think, but people ignore, you know, it's like, you know, if you ask people about the Old Testament, they're like, I mean, you know, D&D is the Old Testament of gaming, right? It's like, like there's like witch stoning and village burning, and we just don't play those rules, right?
Right.
So,
tune in, everybody, to the next session, to the next episode of RPG X-Ray, when we discuss who is the New Testament bearer of role-playing games.
Right. I'm sure we could come up with an answer here.
I totally agree with what you said, Ethan. I feel like that is exactly right. When I play Gumshoe, I'm always not sure, what am I trying to do? Am I just experiencing it? Or am I trying to, or is it about me trying to overcome the challenge of figuring out the mystery? Mm-hmm. As I've said, we've all been talking about eventually playing Dracula Dossier, which I think is a great, amazing concept. But I don't think I would play it with Gumshoe. I think I would play it with some...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, some Forged in the Dark variant or something. Not because I'm in love with that, but
we've got the Old Testament, the New Testament. Now we have our first heresy. This is
there
great.
There you go. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, Jason, let me loop back for a second because I think...
Yeah.
I do want to close a little bit on this topic of can you have curiosity in a world where the players are creating the solution. So I will say, just for myself, I am always finding this disappointing. I always go into these indie games that are indie mysteries where the players come up with the solution and I'm like, oh, there's going to be so much agency.
Right.
And then I just always walk away with like, and I know like Andrew, who's one of our players who played in Inspectors with us. And he was like, wow, that was amazing. But I always walk away feeling a little disappointed because I don't feel that sense of curiosity. And I want to know from you guys, is that something that you both share and you feel like, you know, clearly we have a good table and so we have fun doing a lot of stuff, but maybe that's just not the right way to do mysteries. What do you guys think?
So I would say a lot of times, like, I think the reason why everyone at the table had such a good time with, Inspectors I would say it's a very satisfying game as a player because you're able to be very expressive in it. You're kind of co-creating, you're doing a lot of you're doing a lot of the DM work, right? And I think sometimes as a DM you're like, well, all right, whatever. Like, this isn't like as fun as I have this cool thing and I can't wait to see the player's reaction when this happens, because that doesn't happen because the players are the ones who are kind of mainly inventing that, right? I think that'd be very hard to do for a mystery game. You know, I think that, you know, you essentially like kind of maybe a player generated. That's why I haven't played Brindlewood Bay yet. I'm curious to see how it plays at the table, right? But like, I am kind of curious about like the genre of mysteries. Feels like it's the one that needs the most authorship from the GM at the table and would suffer the most from kind of player co-creation. I don't know if that's the correct way to view it or not, but it certainly came to me as you were talking about just kind of how our table experienced some of the games.
Just to add to that, one of the things I've sort of been thinking about this session, during this conversation, is whether or not you can, and that we've done this, we've all done this, right? We can adapt the end of a campaign based on where the players are looking, what their attentional focus is, right? They're fixated on X, therefore X is actually going to be, you know, a core part of the story where it wasn't planned to be such. So we dynamically allocate resources and like folk, you know, based on player focus. Okay. And I think that you could potentially sometimes do that. I don't think you can always do it. I think sometimes you can do it if the mystery maps nicely onto it. So for instance, maybe it's not the prince who is behind it. It's the Viscount, or it's the, you know, the accountant in the, you know, the castle, right? So you can adapt it. You can change up a little bit based on player interest. I think where that really potentially breaks down is in that big overarching arc. Although, you know, I guess you probably have like the first 30% of the cosmic horror or the conspiramid or the seasonal mystery and in the Veronica Mars context, you probably have the first 30% of that arc to work through, where you can still adapt it and change it based on where the players are looking,
isn't
what their interests are. But I think past that sort of first 30% of that seasonal arc, you really get into dangerous territory where it starts to just feel kind of like a seat of the pants, you know? And that is, to me, unsatisfying. And I think that some mysteries, some episodic mysteries can be done kind of seat of the pants where you're like rearranging stuff on the fly. I think if the players know you're doing that, I feel like it's a little less satisfying.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, one place where I feel like, and you started, this is how you started the episode, Ethan, was talking about that middle piece in that three act structure, the synthesis integration.
Yeah.
I think there's been a ton of innovation in games talking about how do you do clue finding? And it's something we talk about all the time. But outside of Brindlewood Bay and the things that are based off of it, I would love to see much more innovation in mechanics around how you do that synthesis piece, or how do players benefit mechanically from clue finding in those other later phases of the game. It's not like I have one in the back of my pocket that I'm waiting to pull out, but I feel like it's a place that's ripe for innovation.
Is it?
Yeah, we have, like, Gumshoe nails the clue finding part, I think. Right? It has a good, solid answer to that. It's where D&D falls down, and the Gumshoe solution is clues. You get them. That's it.
Right. Right.
And then the third part, which is taking action, D&D and Gumshoe both okay on that. Right?
Is it?
D&D's all about taking action. Yep. Gumshoe, you have plenty of, you know, facility there. But that synthesis part, yeah, that's really a big, that's like sort of the missing piece.
Yeah.
And probably why, like, to nail it down, that's why Gumshoe doesn't happen as much as I might like it to at our table. And it is because I don't have a good answer to, like, how, where does that synthesis occur and how should
that's
it
right.
occur?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas in D&D, ironically, I think you do have a good answer, which is like, you just have to make it happen on your own because the rules don't account for it at all. And they never right. will. And they're That's terrible right. at doing it. And they also suck at clue finding. So everything you're doing is like off brand, off book.
Totally.
It's interesting. It's a weird thing where the lack of system support for an aspect of play is what makes that part of play possible.
Yeah.
Like, rulings over rules, baby.
That's
rulings
right.
over rules.
Yeah. That's right. No, you're exactly right. So that's fascinating.
All right. Well, I feel like this is a great place to wrap up. I know we like to wrap up the end of every episode by going around and talking a little bit about what are we going to take away from this for our table. Jason, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think for me, what I really took away was what I was talking about earlier, which was, I think I'm going to use the Conspiramid. I'm going to go build it out for Masks of Nyarlathotep. I'm in the middle of, you know, unpacking after a move. I have to go find my Knight's Black Agents book somewhere. But I think that applying the Conspiramid to Masks will really benefit my ability to construct the second kind of half of the campaign, which we're about to begin soon.
And I think that my takeaway is definitely this. That three component, like the fact that we've made that a little bit more explicit, the clues, synthesis, and action. Starting to think about my scenarios and sessions and larger campaign arcs in that framework, and then also that kind of dual tier mystery solving. I feel like I can squeeze a little bit more of a structured, explicit framework out of this somehow.
Is there
one that isn't necessary? It's sort of the Uber framework that is. It doesn't exist in any of the rule sets that I have read. Maybe it does, and I just didn't read them closely enough. But I'd like to think about that more on a kind of a meta level.
For me, it's definitely also about that three-act structure. I think we were, like, I really enjoy that explicit framework for that. And then in addition, really thinking about, this is something I've been thinking about a while, but I think it really hit me during this discussion that really mystery games are not investigation games. They're really curiosity-based games.
Is it?
Thinking about how I use that more often in mystery games. And I think that that's pretty interesting.
that's it for this episode of RPG X-Ray. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us improve the show and reach more listeners who share our passion for role-playing games. As always, we hope this episode has given you some new insights and ideas for your own table. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us on our website or social media channels available in the show notes and at rpgxray.com.